things.
Savvy and outward.
I don't know.
Afternoon, just a couple of housekeeping things. We have the social this afternoon at 5. We're pretty pumped about it. We've got some really nice door prizes as well that we're going to offer. Beer, wine, some food provided. So it should be fun. Great way to network with folks. Lunch was great. Thanks for everyone chatting with a lot of the vendors and the exhibitors. They're great people. They got some really useful products that can be really beneficial. Also, just before we're going to start our panel, just to go over the remainder of the agenda, we're going to start in here. We're going to have about a 30-45 minute panel with Alistair McCaw, Lauren Landau, and Dr. Nick DeNugli. And then we're going to transition into the practical part of the afternoon over in the room next door, and we're going to do 4 30-minute short presentations focused on specific areas of 10 specific training. So it's going to be the real practical piece of today. But before we do that, I'd just like to get everyone up and actually move down this way. We're going to take a group photo. We've got some phenomenal people in the room. We just want to capture this. We'll get this to everyone so you've got it. You can stand up and make your way down here. And we'll get a group photo. We're going to face this way now. Yeah. Some of the shorter folks actually up on the stage. And then we could get people in these two parts here.
Go ahead.
That's
Thanks everyone for taking the time to do that. This is, to me, some of the most exciting parts of events, is getting guys that have unique experiences to kind of share their knowledge in an informal way. So having a panel set up is great. Some of you have seen Dr. Nick's previous speech on the aging athlete. He also has a lot of experience working with elite level professionals in a lot of different sports, so he's wealth of knowledge. Brian, you just saw do a great presentation, and I know there were a lot of questions following that, so feel free to ask away. And then Alistair's going to follow this panel with a great presentation. And for people that don't know, Alistair, he's worked in tennis for many, many years. He was a player, but he played some high level tennis. He's worked with a ton of professional players, ton of junior development players, still works with a ton on tour right now. One of his current students, Kevin Anderson, is having a standout year. So congratulations to you and the team, you're doing phenomenally well. And it's just great for us to learn and listen. So I know there's a lot of questions, I'm not even going to start this off. Who's got questions out there based on what they saw from Lauren's presentation or anything else that is of interest right now?
Question regarding dynamic stretching, static stretching. I come with a background in RTS. Lauren, you know a little bit about that as well, and MAT. What stance do you have on that regarding for tennis athletes?
I said with my athletes, it's 100% dynamic all the time, pre-session. Post-session, you know, post-session, they're done for the day, whatever they want to do. That goes back to pick my battles. I just know that there's some athletes, I can sit there and regurgitate different information, but there's certain things that allow a player to, or a person to sleep better at night, or, you know, I just feel better when I do this. Who am I to say how you feel? I will say, though, prior to, you know, on-court sessions or my dynamic sessions, it's always active dynamic with some isometrics in there as well, as you're familiar with the MAT side. So I'll do positional isometrics at end range, but I'm not going into passive holds or anything like that ever prior to it. To me, anytime somebody's doing that, you're putting the tissue, you know, in an inhibited state where it's, you're telling it, hey, just go to sleep. No, I need it to be active and ready. So if you want to do it before bed and then the neurological system, you know, resets, cool. But never pre.
I would agree with that, but I would add that this, especially as you get a little older and muscles get tighter, if you have imbalances that you know about or old injuries, there is still a role for static stretching. I don't know about it. Pre-activity, I'm not big on that, but I think you need to work to get rid of those imbalances and contractures. Properly done static stretching isn't going to harm you, especially if it's later. But I just see so many athletes with obvious imbalances where it's almost predictable what injuries they're going to have. So I personally, before tennis, would prefer a more dynamic warm-up. But I mean dynamic stretch, but also, again, with older athletes and with anybody, warm-up's different. You know this warm-up, I'm sure everybody in this room knows this, but warm-up is different than stretching. You want some blood flowing. I showed some slides of abnormal tendons and how inelastic they are. And if you get blood flowing to an abnormal tissue, it behaves more elastically, a property called viscoelasticity, that when things get warmer, they behave a little more like taffy. So you want to warm up a little, especially, you know, young kids, you can get away with anything. They're gummies. But if you get over 40, you're going to get in trouble if people just go out. And I see it every day when I play. Nobody takes the time for dynamic or static where they get out there and they want to hit that first ball so hard, and then you're going to tear more tissue doing that than a properly done stretching program.
I think it's a great question to start with, because that's exactly what I'm going to be going to in the next presentation. The warm-up and the sequence of the dynamic flexibility or movement preparation, whatever you want to call it. So we're going to be going through that. And same as Lauren and Nick. Dynamic flexibility before. I like to switch on the hips, definitely before each session, activate the hips as a big area, which we're going to see in the presentation today. And then afterwards, the static stretching with the stretch strap, which I know Dr. Mark Kovacs is big into as well. He got his again, it's a hips before, hips after approach there as well, where we stretch the adductor, the hamstring, psoas, and the abductor as well. So, yeah, same approach, but never static before. So.
And for adults, you all know the
four areas. For adults, it's going to be front of the shoulder, lower back, hamstring, and calves are your problem areas most likely. If you have a runner, you multiply it by 10, and those areas are going to be extremely, extremely tight. A lot of it created by your own fitness routines that are not balanced. You can create imbalances depending on your sport or your fitness.
Do you recommend a good resource for some of the speed training we were looking at with you earlier, especially for those of us coaching every day? Might not be at the MTPS level, but want to do a good job in training speed and movement.
Absolutely. There's actually a current project I'm working on. And it's a website, www.elitesportservices.com. And there's a ton of information on there where it's on the speed side, but it's also into the weight room, a lot of different roundtable discussions that we're going to have, hopefully all these gentlemen on at some point. But it's a good resource, I think, for that. I think if you can read anything from Dan Papp, P-F-A-F-F, Lauren Seagrave, anything from Nick Winkleman, I think that those are just phenomenal people to read.
Mark
Verstegen as well, absolutely.
Especially with Mark Verstegen, sorry.
I have a few people that I keep close to in the industry, and Mark Verstegen, Mike Boyle, Vern Gambetta. Not everybody agrees with each other, and that's the industry we're in. I think that's one point that was, I'm getting off the subject a little bit here, which I'm world class at. I was at an NBA basketball conference 2 weeks ago in Orlando, and Stan Van Gundy of Detroit Pistons, now he was with Orlando, discussed, you know, we've got to get on the same line as coaches, we've got to stick together. And I think what's the most valid point there is we're all going to have different opinions, we're all going to have different views. That's what makes the industry exciting, but the main thing is respecting those views. But my point is, before I went home, was that Mark Verstegen was, the pioneer of lateral movement. He was the first one to really get into more lateral movement, because there wasn't a lot about that. There was a lot of agility. Mike Boyle breaks down speed and agility very easy. Speed is from A to B as quick as you can, and agility is A to B and back to A again. And, you know, when you have people like that, you just bring a simple message across to guys like myself, because I'm sitting here with probably three of the smartest guys in the industry. It's a breath of fresh air, so.
Can you talk about first step explosivity and how you train that, please?
Sure.
To develop a first, you know, your first step, I think having it be as powerful as you can. And also, if you talk about people bashing each other, when you start from a parallel stance, what is the foot that's going forward first?
Ah, love it. You guys mind if I start?
Here you go.
Okay. So, first step power. First step power. I think sometimes we label things in our industry as. Okay, I'm going to go back to almost where Alistair was just a moment ago. Everybody wants absolute in this room, okay, or in this industry, right? We get warm and fuzzy over research, and we get warm and fuzzy over that. At the end of the day, there are zero absolutes. There's opinions. There's opinions based on evidence. There's opinions based on experience. I will say this. I think the first step quickness, I look at it as first step quickness, or how do I get myself right into the best body position. Let's just take a general movement pattern. There's something that is typically known as a false step. And people talk about false steps. Say I'm going straight ahead. We're in a set of position, and a lot of coaches, and let's just be sport generic right now. A lot of coaches say that if I do anything behind myself, it's a false step. I'm slowing myself down. My step needs to be forward, going toward my direction. I disagree with that. I think that the step, it's called, I call it a rhythm step, or a drop step, or a jab step. You pick it, I don't care. But to me, it's a redirection. I'm trading inches for angles. And so what I'm trying to do is, if I try to take my first step positive, I'm in a vertical body position, my tibia is vertical, that means my force when I hit the ground is going to go there a lot too. I'm going to move forward because of the push here, but my next step is not. To me, if I'm in a set position, I take a slight step back, that jab step, what it does is automatically augments body position, torso position, to put me in a more advantageous position to go straight line fast, 2, 3, 4 steps, whatever it is. Now, a lot of things people always talk about, because we talk about it in the weight room all the time, triple extension, triple extension, triple extension. And this is where we have to understand technical models versus reality. We can look at a technical model of a sprinter coming out of blocks. We can look at a technical model of somebody coming out of a 40 start and say, we need to get this great hip extension, blah, blah, blah. We know ourselves that if we tell an athlete to get great hip extension, but the next step they might have to go lateral, probably isn't the best case for power and most effective power. So to me, it's not about how much power, it's about what's optimal for the position that I'm in. Does that make sense? If I sit there and I ask them to give me full hip extension, but then I need them to break down change of direction, I put them in a disadvantaged position. So I think it's a matter of understanding where these technical models fit into our complex, chaotic nature of sport. Anybody get that? Did I ever say that all year?
I'm a firm believer of stepping in the direction first step. I'm not a big advocate of the pio step or the tall step, as they call it. In a sport that is multi-directional, such as tennis, squash, badminton, for me, it's more a first push than a first step, as I explained, getting off the mark. So if I'm in this position and I'm running to my left, excuse me, that is going to be my directional pivot of the foot, and that's going to be my load and push off. You know, as Lauren explained in his presentation, if I'm moving to the left, it's my right leg that's going to be driving that force to the side. So for me, I had this discussion with Vern as well, and the guys get all heated about it, and that's why I said one of my first points is let's respect difference of opinion, listen. But for me, I don't like the term first step. I like the term first push, because you are loading and pushing off with that first movement, in my opinion, and then the other leg is pushing off. On the other side, where I do agree with Lauren is that in a sport where it's just linear, for example, 40-yard sprint or 100-meter sprint, they do start in that position, so in the blocks. So from that point, absolutely, if you're running straight or in a linear direction. But for a sport that's multi-directional, I believe in the turn of the foot in the direction where you're moving and the first push. So
yeah, and just to kind of go back off of what and this is exactly what it's about right here. It's about having different opinions based on context and perspective. Because we can sit there and say, well, first push, and first thing I think of is, where's my weight? Where's my weight distribution? So my mind starts calculating, okay, it's not just going to happen from the static thing. If I'm talking about the static thing, then there's this optimal way to get there. I did have a gentleman doing, and this is slightly anecdotal and empirical, but a gentleman did his master's with me, and what he did is I was presenting at a conference, and I was talking about that rhythm step. And he came up to me and said, I'd like to come spend some time with you. He came and spent 2 months with me, and I kind of showed him what it was that I was doing. And he went back to school, and he actually made his research based on linebackers in college football. And two different ways, because the linebacking coaches just want them to take that first step positive, where if you watch an athlete innately react, you know what they do? Step back. They step back. And so what he did is he actually did his research based on that on 20 different players, or 20 different athletes at linebacker position, from freshman to senior, and everybody that did the drop step was faster. Everybody, across the board. And he actually went back to his linebacker coach and showed them this, and I don't think they believe the data. But I think it's a matter of perspective of what it is that you're doing. Again, I've always used the term trading inches for angles, and that seems to really justify it.
Can I play vehicle map between these two on this one? Because in a way, they're both right. Because there was a study back in the late 90s, and they actually compared the drop step versus taking the first forward step, and it had to do with the distance that they wanted to cover. If you wanted to cover more than about 3 yards, taking the drop step had benefit. If you were shorter than that, you actually lost your time based on that. So that what they're both saying is kind of correct. And multi-directional is different to linear as well. So there's the joint angles and the issues with that. So I don't think they're as far apart as they let me sound on that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's funny because when I heard that question, it was a debate that turned into a two-hour fight in Portland, Oregon. And I was at the Nike three-day basketball conference, and it almost turned into a riot. People were leaving early and so on over that question. So when you asked that, I was like, oh boy.
Maybe that's why they asked
it. Okay, next question. Let's move on. There.
Start with that. I think if it's supervised, you can start with weights. I don't think there's any magic. It's resistance. It's the problem with kids is if you give them weights and you leave them alone, it turns into an Olympic competition, and you get growth plate fractures and things like that. But the idea that you're going to slow down, the old thinking of slowing down growth or injuring kids with weights, bands and functional movements are probably the best when they're younger. But implementing bands, free weights, as long as it's supervised and they're not trading, never sacrificing form for the amount of weight that they lift. You put a bunch of young boys together, especially, and you give them weight, and you leave for 5 minutes, and somebody's on the ground, right? So I don't know that there's a real age, as long as it's supervised and done right. And it's important. It's essential if you want to be an athlete to be lifting.
I think for me, regardless of what the resistance is, there's got to be whether it's a band, there's plenty of issues that can go wrong there. Body weight exercises, I think sometimes we sit there and say, oh, those are safe. No, those can be done quite poorly. So to me, it's a matter of the emotional maturity that the athlete possesses. Because I can have an athlete who's 16 and from a training potential, should be right and ready to go, but from an emotional state, they're not. You may have to pull them back and curtail them. And quite honestly, I have currently a 12-year-old tennis player, and she and I are doing all the Olympic lifts, and we're doing them with dowels, and we're doing them with unloaded bars, and we're doing them with training bars. But she's got the emotional maturity as well to be able to handle that. So you have to be smart and understand the big picture, the long-term picture, and understand if you like this micro progression is ultimately the goal and the key. And, I think emotional maturity goes a long way in all of that.
Well said, Lauren. When I was listening to your presentation, I was just nodding the whole time because we have a lot of the same views. But where I'm going to disagree, and that's why we're here, is because we have differences of opinions. But I'm not a big weights guy for kids up until 14. That's the age for me where specialization starts. 14 is a golden age for me. It's where the most dropouts are. It's where you've got to be playing as many sports as possible. It's also an area for me where I just keep the kids I train totally functional. Medicine balls, bands, master your body weight, as Lauren said as well. Can you do a proper push-up without collapsing the hips, setting your hips? Can you do a pull-up? For kids, the pull-ups would probably be the 45-degree ones, not the totally straight ones. A lot of functional work, plyo work, and of course playing a lot of games. For me, basketball is a fantastic sport, soccer, hockey, whatever it may be. That's the field hockey, not the ice hockey. So that's my view there as well. That doesn't mean, I'm like totally against it. No waste until you're 14, because fantastic point. You get an 11-year-old that's 5'8" and a 16-year-old that's scrawny and 5'2". Where do you draw the line there? So I think that comes down to what that kid needs. But for me, that's around the age where I start to introduce a little bit more resistance training with weights.
and keep it totally functional.
The back.
Keeping on the idea of functional training and movement, can you speak about the two different populations, both you and you know, the younger ones, and also some of the older youth? I mean, 50 and above. You know, in terms of fostering rotational movement.
Yes, I think with adults, I'll cover that. You guys maybe heard the kids. Got to be a little careful, because if you heard some of my talk, you lose muscle, you lose some neural connections, you lose that connectivity. We talked about what was once Comcast high speed DSL wiring. You know, you're back to dial up again sometimes. And if they've had surgery, if they've had a joint replacement, their proprioception's off. So you can get into trouble quick if you try to mimic some of the kinds of things that we saw you doing with that group. But they're anxious and they want to do stuff, and they'll do it. If you say, I have a dear friend who high-level tennis player for many years, and the coach just wanted to maybe try some new stuff and try a one-legged jump while serving, and she tore her ACL, I mean, that quickly, and she was out for, you know, 9 months. So I think, but I also think that you need some of that for adults. You need to work on some of this directional change and functional movements, and you're gonna give something that's gonna help them way beyond the tennis court as adults. This is an aging population. You're talking about healthful aging and preventing falls and preventing muscle loss. So yeah, you know, you're gonna get a lot more from some of this tennis drills than the risk. So it's risk reward. Like, you just can't do what you were doing with somebody. And progression, mini progression. See how they're doing. See how they move. Test them first. Test them with a simple thing. I have patients that have had knee replacements who tell me they're not doing well. I just ask them to do a yoga tree pose. You know, on their good leg, they're like this. Bad leg, even with their eyes open, they have no proprioception. And so, but they'll get it back if you work them. So they might need to start out with something simple like that, stationary, and then start with some slow movement patterns. And then playing tennis is going to give them a lot of that too, which is why I'm so for it for aging populations.
What was the question again? again, it comes down to the athleticism of the kid as well, looking at their background. I've had some kids come to me from other trainers or other sports where the first thing I look at is posture, and Lauren spoke about that, because that's definitely the growth spurt around the 12, 13, 14 area where a lot of damage can be done. Also, if they've just been specializing in tennis, you're going to see some issues there, scoliosis, hips, all these type of things as well. So it really comes down to doing your research on the history of the athlete. Like I said, I've seen some incredibly fit athletes. Their 40-yard time's good. They're benching 150, whatever it may be, but they don't know how to run. They haven't been taught how to run. They can't, as Nick just said, they're not putting them on one leg and they can't stand on one leg. And for me, it's about getting back to those basics. You know, Lauren and Nick will agree with me that there's some kids that are 11 that are better athletes than kids that are 17, you know, and that are in sport. They've just had better training. And that's the important thing, is as coaches and parents, to find quality trainers who understand the LTAD, the Long-Term Athlete Development Plan, and understand the psychological and physiological changes of the kids, right? You and Lauren and I were just speaking about this in the hallway, of those changes, not just from a physical point of view, but from a psychological point of view.
Yeah, I think obviously from my lecture you can see that I'm a movement-based practitioner first and foremost, and darn near only. But to me, you know, it comes down to individualizing it. You know, we always talk about it, but yet we always want this kind of nice, easy cut answer. And, you know, everybody's going to display something different. You know, what we term as functional for one person could be highly dysfunctional for another, and vice versa. So at the end of the day, I just look at the individual who's in front of me. Posture is my priority. Restoring posture to hopefully eradicate some of the overuse, repetitive stress-based injuries. And, you know, doing that through, you know, various warm-up strategies, hip strategies, trunk training strategies, shoulder, if you want to call them correctives, whatever you want to call them. But at the end of the day, understand that posture dictates function. And we need to keep that in mind with these athletes who are so one-sided in a sport such as tennis. We've really got to pay attention to that because, you know, actually, I just had a conversation with one of my mentors, Greg Roscoff, University, you know, and I asked him, I said, Greg, you know, because we always talk about asymmetries, and imbalances. A couple of things we understand is that there's some imbalances that make some of these athletes special. And if we eradicate all of them, are we taking away from their capability? Possibly. And I also asked him this, I said, if we find somebody who is imbalanced, what we would deem to be dysfunctional movement pattern via a screen, but if they have no pain, if they're asymptomatic, is it a problem? And I think that begs, we always want to, again, we always want a clean cut answer on everything, and we want to try to fit in our little box. I think at the end of the day, we have to sit there and say, you know, if I put you in this position of what I would deem balanced, do I create a problem? So I think you have to look at the individual who's in front of you, young or old, and, you know, your goal and your job is to hopefully minimize their likelihood of injury in doing so in the least invasive way possible. Does that make any sense?
I think what opened my eyes to this was about 4 or 5 years ago at India Wells. They were doing the FMS test on all the players, which was compulsory back then. And I'm not going to mention any names, but she's an Olympic silver medalist and Grand Slam finalist. Failed the FMS miserably. I think 6 out of 7 elements she got 1, that was 2 out of 3 points that they reward. So it's just amazing the type of athletes you can see, you know, just like Lauren there said now. You've seen some of the most poor specimens of athletes somehow figure it out. Your body's going to figure it out. It's going to be up to you. And long term, you know, the body is going to break down eventually. So,
question.
Dr. Smith, I guess earlier in your talk, you talked about the golfer's elbow, tennis elbow. Do you think that has more to do with equipment or just bad technique or a combination of both?
Good question about golfers. I think it's both, actually. It's going to vary player to player. As you probably know, the recreational hackers will get more lateral epicondylitis or outer side, usually related to the end of the ball length. They're wristing it. They're not hitting the backhand properly. You don't see a lot of that with two-handed backhands, so I think there's technical issues there. On the inner side of the elbow, you were seeing that more on the pros and the people who hit well. I think it's just the type of hit. The stiffer frames, the stiffer strings, that all sends a force right to that area. That is a weak link on many players. And if you add overload, inadequate recovery, you know, overuse and under recovery are kind of the same coin,
yeah.
Different sides of the same coin. And you break down, and then with age you get changes in your tendons. What we talked about, tendinopathy, whether you know it or not, you've got some changes going on. It doesn't take much overload to do that. So I think you got to look at it. You got to look at their equipment, you know, their strings, their type of racket. I developed it. You know, I think I hit a great forehand. I've been playing a long time. I've never had a problem with it. And I love the racket. I don't think it's the racket, but I demoed the new Fed frame, which is a lot stiffer. And I had it strong with Lux, which was probably a mistake for that brain. And for the first time ever, I was raw here when I kept playing because I'm an idiot. And now I'm dealing with that. So with me, I don't think it's technique because my technique didn't change at all, but I instantly noticed the difference with an equipment change. So it's a tough problem.
Because I've noticed with the introduction of the lighter racket, a lot of people have developed the elbow problem because of the ability to use just the wrist to hit the ball instead of shoulder and I guess power from the legs.
Correct.
So
and the smaller, a lot of people are going with smaller grips so they can whip it,
yeah.
Too. Hit a nice ball that way, but you're changing the stresses. You have any thoughts on it?
I'll pass.
This week we were training with the Bryan brothers down in Miami, and we were just talking about this thing as well, where
elite athletes, pro athletes that develop such a good structure. If you have a look at Faith's forearm, for example, you have a look at the tennis player's forearm, the right, or if the right dominant is there, and the left is more like Federer's forearm is the size of my quad. But we were talking about the change of the rackets. Again, not going to mention any names with brands and so on, but you can do your own assessment of this, where certain racket companies brought out a racket with holes along the side that with the idea of having quicker rackets, and some people were having issues from that. Another area is players adding weight to the racket, where Dinara Safina played with a 375. Gulbis plays with the heaviest 410. Can you imagine holding that racket out with that forearm? So those small little things, the small details of racket weights, grip size. Mark's definitely more clued up on this than I am with fitting a kid with the right racket, the right weight, the racket that suits the kid's game, where they are in their development. But so many cases, racket weight and grip size are already done. Yeah.
So I wish we had more time. We've got so many good things coming up. That went in a flash. I just want to thank the panelists for giving up their time and expertise. So now we're going to move over into the other room. Alistair is going to take us through a real practical dynamic warm-up and talk through that.